Hello, I'm David Crow. Thank you for listening to episode 150 of The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.FM, or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. Now is a good time to thank Annette from Washington State for her very kind donation. If you'd like to sponsor this show as an individual or an advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. See theinfectiousmyth.com/donate.php for a PayPal button. If you want to make monthly donations, please go to patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Even a few dollars a month helps. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. As you will soon find out, this month I went to a legal philosophy conference in Lisbon, Portugal, presented a paper, submitted a paper and presented a talk at that conference, and I'd certainly like to do more of that. I funded the entire thing out of my own pocket. It would be nice to have some support so that I could do more of that and hopefully get some of the ideas that you might care about more widely known, or at least alternative viewpoints on some of the issues you might care about. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you listening, commenting, and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. On Monday, July 17th, I gave a talk on the criminalization of HIV at the 28th World Congress on the Philosophy of Law and Social Philosophy at the University of Lisbon School of Law. Apart from my talk, accompanied by some slides, I also submitted a detailed article complete with references. I will provide links to both of them in the show notes. I noticed a couple of things with the other talks that I listened to, mostly from lawyers and law students. One was that the lawyers preferred to talk about the theory of the law, the philosophy of law, rather than practical applications. There's nothing wrong with this within limits. Computer science has, for example, the Turing machine, an imaginary computer that can never exist because, first of all, it would be incredibly slow, but it also requires an infinitely large memory. But thinking about it and analyzing it has revealed important concepts about computers and computer programming. One can liken the law to a complex and highly tuned machine, which is admirable, but it relies on inputs like all machines. Instead of connections for electricity, water, fuel, air, it has various types of evidence from police, expert witnesses, documents, eyewitnesses, and more. And often the problems arise because the inputs are corrupted. If you connect DC instead of AC electricity to the machine, and sewage instead of clean water, and gasoline instead of propane, and hydrogen instead of air, there's no point in worrying about the inner workings of the machine. Similarly, if you accept police testimony corrupted by the desire to hide wrongdoing, and confessions that may be false, and experts who always want to help the prosecution, and state-funded defense lawyers who are underfunded or incompetent or both, it doesn't matter how beautiful your machine is. The reason for injustices is not because the machine is broken or flawed. It's because the inputs require human judgment, and humans are subject to the seven deadly sins and a lot more. Humans with power tend to want to keep the power and its advantages, such as money and status. And if that means that somebody has to be thrown in the slammer once in a while, they don't see that as their problem. The machine of justice helps cover up and justify their errors. We have an expression in the land of computers, GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. If you have a numerical computer program designed to produce a number as an output, it will produce a number even if your inputs are all meaningless. Similarly, if you have a corrupted justice machine that accepts unjust charges and unjust and corrupted evidence, it will give the same legal stamp of approval on the unjust convictions as on the justified convictions. I said as much during the conferences, and all the lawyers laughed and nodded their heads in agreement, and then went back to discussing their beautiful machine. But I wanted to talk about real law and real cases and how that results in a grand injustice for HIV-positive people, especially for those who are sexually active, i.e., like the vast majority of people on this planet, at least when people are young and healthy. I started my talk by talking about the moral burden of HIV risk groups. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, the groups with the most annual diagnosis of HIV infections are gay men, IV drug users, and around the world, black-skinned people. People who are progressive would say that there's no moral burden, perhaps for any of those groups, possibly even not for IV drug users. But in reality, gay men have been prejudiced against historically, and still are many places in the world. There are countries where you can be imprisoned or even killed for being gay. Many people believe that IV drug use is a personal failing. The slogan, "Just say no to drugs," seems really easy for people who aren't addicted. And clearly, there's no moral failing in being born with black skin. But for centuries, and still today, black-skinned people are seen as more sexually promiscuous, especially men, more criminal than white people, despite the facts and despite the evidence. So all of the groups who are associated with a high risk of HIV infection, which is believed to be associated with a high risk of AIDS, have a moral burden imposed on them. Whether it's valid or not, the moral burden exists. And I believe this has a big impact on accepting that HIV-positive people who have sex and don't reveal their status are worse than people with other diseases or other conditions who may have sex without revealing their status. I used Canada as a legal example because in Canada, the criminalization of HIV is basically a federal matter. In the United States, the 50 states have different laws. Many states have HIV-specific laws. In Canada, there is no HIV-specific law. There are just common law precedents. The first was Currier in 1998, which was updated in 2012 with two decisions named Mabior and the anonymous woman named DC. Canada uses the laws of fraud to prosecute HIV. This doesn't result in charges of fraud, but of aggravated sexual assault or even first-degree murder through a simple chain of logic. In all the cases used to establish legal precedence in Canada, the sexual contact was consensual, but one party did not disclose their HIV-positive status to the other, the HIV-negative party. This led the courts to treat the sex as non-consensual, using the logic that no person in their right mind would agree to sex with an HIV-positive person, but If they did, it would not have been a crime. So this is a strange weapon. If the person agrees that you can use it, it's no longer a crime. I guess you can liken this to a violent sport like boxing or wrestling, where normally if you punch somebody, that would be considered assault. But if you agree to get in the ring with somebody, it's no longer assault. Anyway, we now have logic that flows pretty easily. Non-consensual sex is in many countries called rape, but in Canada it's called sexual assault. Since HIV is considered a deadly virus, a deadly weapon, it's treated as aggravated sexual assault. This results in long sentences. In the example of Carleone, a white Canadian businessman, which makes him kind of unusual amongst the group of people sentenced for HIV-related cases in Canada. The sentence was calculated as 49 years, but was reduced to 18 based on the so-called totality principle, not counting 3 years of pretrial house arrest for which he was not given credit. So you could consider it a 21-year sentence, which is almost as long as life in Canada, which is 25 years before the first opportunity for parole. This is similar to another person who received a 15-year sentence around the same time based on similar charges. This punishment is meted out regardless of whether the alleged victims have become HIV positive or not. In the 1998 decision Currier, for example, it said, quote, at the time of trial, neither complainant had tested positive for the virus. HIV antibody status of a victim only increases the charges or punishment of if a person dies of an illness that can be considered AIDS. In this case, we have automatic first-degree murder, because in Canada, if somebody dies within 2 years of a sexual assault, of something that's considered related to the sexual assault, it's automatic first-degree murder. So if somebody dies of an illness that fits under the umbrella of AIDS after sexual contact with someone who did not disclose, it could be considered first-degree murder. As far as I know, there's only one case in Canada. In 2011, Johnson Aziga was convicted of first-degree murder and was sentenced to life in prison. There is a little bit of a problem with the Aziga case, because I was told in confidence by one of his lawyers that the two sexual partners who died took AIDS drugs and died from an acknowledged side effect of AZT. The drug's product monograph, the detailed label published by the manufacturer, says, quote, it was often difficult to distinguish adverse events possibly associated with administration of retrovir, also known as AZT, from underlying signs of HIV disease or intercurrent illnesses, end quote. Although AZT is no longer frequently used in Western countries, all AIDS drug cocktails contain at least one drug in the same class, nucleoside analog, which have similar side effects. The protection against such severe charges and penalties provided by Currier in 1998 were either disclosure of the HIV positive status to your sexual partner or consistent use of condoms. In 2012, when this law was reconsidered, a lot of people thought that it would be loosened up somewhat, but it was actually tightened by adding the condition of low viral load. So what you now have in Canada is you either have to disclose or you have to do both use condoms and have a low viral load. And the only way to reliably establish a low viral load is to take antiretroviral drugs despite the side effects. So it is, in effect, mandatory therapy. Now, a lot of people think this is pretty reasonable. You should just disclose your status. Again, why is this not as easy as it sounds? Well, first of all, one problem with many criminal sexual allegations is that sexual contact usually takes place in private with only two people present, potentially the future accuser and the future accused in a criminal case. Even if a person discloses their HIV positive status to their partner and uses a condom consistently, there will probably be no witnesses or other evidence. In the case of the so-called DC, an anonymous woman, she was originally convicted because the court believed a doctor who claimed that she had talked to him about a condom that slipped off. And that he didn't believe the condom had slipped off. He believed that she wasn't using a condom at all and that she was lying. The original court believed the doctor, but the Supreme Court discarded the doctor's testimony, reverting to a he said, she said. He said she didn't use a condom. She said she did. They gave the benefit of the doubt to the defendant, the woman, DC. But in other cases, they might believe the testimony of the HIV negative partner. The same problem occurs with disclosure. If someone discloses their HIV positive status to a sexual partner in private, and the negative partner later denies this, it boils down to the credibility of the two people. It's unlikely that courts in Canada or other Western countries would overtly declare sex while HIV positive to be a crime, but they've not considered the burden they've imposed on HIV positive people that essentially makes it a crime. If an HIV positive person discloses their status, they must do this before they first have sex with the object of their affection. If that person becomes upset and breaks off the relationship at this news, and there's certainly no way to know how it will work out, they may react by telling others. And then the HIV positive person has become outed and may be shunned by their community. Not just shunned sexually, but in all ways. They could lose their job, their housing, their friends, their family. It's true that the person they disclose to may be sympathetic, and this has happened at times. I'm aware of some of these cases. And the person may even be willing to engage in unprotected sex with them. But there's no way to know whether the reaction will be positive, negative, or awful, except to disclose, and then it's too late. The results of one's HIV status becoming public were clearly described by a Thai woman who recently found out that she was HIV negative after living for 12 years with a positive diagnosis. She was diagnosed when she was 8. At that time, her neighbors and schoolmates distanced themselves from her, so she dropped out of school, abandoning her dream of becoming a doctor. She married young, said she used condoms, but she became pregnant anyway and had a child. In this case, the fact that she had unprotected sex saved her because the child was HIV negative, which prompted her to get retested. In Canada, she might have been sent to jail for years if her sexual partner complained that he didn't know she was HIV positive or she had encouraged sex without a condom. In another case in the United States, a woman was caught on video deliberately driving her car into her bicycle riding boyfriend after he told her that he was HIV positive, causing severe injuries. Since even disclosing your HIV status privately and using condoms are not guarantees of protection, being HIV positive is still potentially a crime, even if you disclose and use condoms. Unless you have a witness that all your partners were aware of your HIV antibody status before you first had sex, which is highly unlikely. There is no end of things that could result in a person deciding that they never would have agreed to sexual contact if they'd only known, such as the person's marital status, religion, health status, or wealth. Rather than speculate about whether a man who lies about being a millionaire so that women are more likely to consent to sex with him is actually sexually assaulting women, or whether a woman who lies about being single when she's actually married might have sexually assaulted a man who would not have had sex with her if he'd known, it's better to use a real life case as an example. In 2010, a Palestinian man was jailed for 18 months for rape by deception because he used the name Daniel when he met a woman, which she took to mean that he was Jewish. This would probably be considered highly bigoted by most people and might not be allowed in some countries, but it shows you where we could get if every lie amongst sexual partners was considered a crime. Let's go back to diseases. There are many other viruses than HIV that are believed to be infectious and deadly. For example, the ordinary influenza virus is claimed to kill between 12 and 56,000 Americans every year by the CDC. That's greater than the current number of AIDS deaths every year, which is now under 10,000. If the logic of HIV is carried to its conclusion, one could be charged with aggravated assault, manslaughter, or murder for going to work before becoming uninfectious, if a colleague later comes down with influenza and becomes disabled or dies. Similarly, HPV is believed to lead to cervical cancer and other fatal diseases, and the logic used with HIV could lead to carriers of the virus, male or female, being charged based on some combination of refusing to get vaccinated, not using condoms, and not disclosing their HPV status to sexual partners. The theoretical possibility is raised in the Courier precedent from 1998, although to my knowledge, there are few examples of carriers of other diseases being charged with a crime, and certainly none of them being treated with the severity of HIV with multiple year or even multiple decade sentences. The precedent says, the fraud required to erase consent for sexual assault must carry with it the risk of serious harm. This standard is sufficient to encompass not only the risk of HIV infection, but also other sexually transmitted diseases, which constitute a significant risk of serious harm. It's a nice statement, but the reality is it doesn't seem to apply to any disease other than HIV. One of the precedents quoted by the Supreme Court of Canada was actually incredibly bizarre. It was the case of a man who in 1867 had sex with his 12-year-old niece. His sexual contact was ruled non-consensual, not because of the age of the girl or because it was incest, but because she contracted gonorrhea, and the court ruled that she would not have consented to sex with her uncle if she had known that he had this STD. I suppose if he hadn't had gonorrhea, it would have been fine in 1867 for an uncle to have sex with his 12-year-old niece. He was convicted of inflicting actual bodily harm. But the fact that they had to go back to 1867 to a completely bizarre court case shows that really this type of case did not occur until the era of HIV. It really is based on what I might call HIV exceptionalism, which is the belief that, unlike almost any other disease, HIV is universally fatal. Not sometimes, not often, but always. Since HIV is exceptional, it should get exceptional legal treatment. There have been other cases of similar treatment in other countries. For example, almost 50 women in the United Kingdom who were deemed typhoid carriers were locked up for life between 1907 and the 1950s in a special quarter of a mental asylum, isolated even from the truly insane, with special toilets that flushed with boiling water because of their believed infectivity. When they finally decided that this was a mistake, the few women who remained alive had, by that point, due to their isolation, become completely insane. So it was decided just to move them to a different insane asylum, even though they no longer had to be kept isolated from the rest of the world because of their typhoid status. Perhaps one day we will look on the criminalization of HIV-positive people as a similarly anachronistic cruelty. The dogma of HIV that was basically accepted by the courts can be summarized as the following. A, HIV is a virus. B, it can be accurately detected by tests. C, it is most frequently transmitted by sex. D, it causes immune deficiency. And E, in about 10 years, this leads to a syndrome called AIDS, which soon leads to death. Some of the statements in the Courier precedent, the Courier Supreme Court decision, show the acceptance of this by the courts. It's notable that none of these statements were accompanied by any evidence. They were just written without any citation of another court decision, of expert witness testimony, of a document or anything. The accused was aware of the contagious and life-threatening nature of the disease. The venereal disease of HIV and the AIDS it causes are the cause of terrible suffering and death. The failure to disclose HIV positive status can lead to a devastating illness with fatal consequences. The respondent endangered the lives of the complainants by exposing them to the risk of HIV infection through unprotected sexual intercourse. The possible consequence of engaging in unprotected intercourse with an HIV positive partner is death. The Crown needs to prove that the dishonest effect had the effect of exposing the person consenting to a significant risk of serious bodily harm. The risks of contracting AIDS as a result of engaging in unprotected intercourse meets that test. The deadly consequences that non-disclosure of the risk of HIV infection can have on an unknowing victim make it imperative that as a policy, the broader view of fraud vitiating consent advocated in earlier cases and in the U.S. decisions should be adopted. To have intercourse with a person who is HIV positive will always present risks. The failure to disclose the presence of HIV puts the victims at a significant risk of serious bodily harm. The assault provisions of the Criminal Code are applicable and appropriately framed to deter and punish this dangerous and deplorable behavior. The only time they actually mentioned an opinion, it was of a legal academic, not a medical expert. He said, the consequences of transmission are grave at the moment, and he was writing in 1994, there is no cure. A person infected with HIV is considered to be infected for life. The most pessimistic view is that without a cure, all people infected with the virus will eventually develop AIDS and die prematurely. These statements simply accept the dogma and do not test it in any way. There are, in fact, no statements in the Supreme Court decisions that provide any evidence for the dogma or illustrate any knowledge of the science, let alone question it. But let's look at the dogma. We'll leave the statement that HIV is a virus for the end, but HIV can be accurately detected by tests. There are several technologies that have been used for HIV tests, but the most important are culturing, antibody testing, and viral load. Without going into too many details about these technologies, they, like all known HIV tests, are unvalidated by a gold standard, i.e. something that unambiguously detects HIV. Robert Gallo, the godfather of HIV, in his seminal 1984 papers, found antibodies that he declared to be HIV in a little bit over 90% of people, but he was able to culture HIV in less than half. Culturing is theoretically closer to direct detection of HIV, but this did not result in half of the people being declared as not having HIV. It resulted in culturing being pushed aside and HIV antibody tests dominating. Both tests should have been validated by purifying HIV and injecting it into a susceptible animal. But there's a problem because HIV has never been purified. These flaws are openly admitted by test manufacturers. For example, it's common to see the words, a person who has antibodies to HIV-1 is presumed to be infected with the virus. Viral load tests are newer, but no better. They use a primer that represents a tiny fraction of the consensus HIV genome. But without purification of HIV, it's impossible to know what the HIV genome is, or any part of that genome. Assuming that a genome commonly extracted from people who are HIV antibody positive and rarely from the negative must be from HIV is clearly not sufficient. Ironically, the inventor of the viral load technology, which is known as polymerase chain reaction, a man named Kerry Mullis, who won a Nobel Prize in 1993 for this invention, wrote the foreword to the 1996 book Inventing the AIDS Virus by one of the most foremost critics of the HIV-AIDS dogma, Peter Duisberg. Mullis was highly critical of what he considered the premature acceptance of the theory that HIV caused AIDS. These early AIDS scientists were essentially caught in a trap of circular logic, a tautological trap. Their work relied on assumptions about previous research and about the identity of the materials that they were using. But rather than go backwards to validate the assumption, they accepted them without proof. They wanted to move forwards and allow their work to be used as unproven assumptions in further work, a process that continues today. For example, Gallo was able to culture HIV in less than 50% of the people with AIDS. But without an HIV test, which he was in the process of developing, he could not distinguish AIDS, a syndrome that is a collection of previously known diseases, from the exact same diseases occurring in an HIV-negative person. So he could not know that the people he was testing had AIDS. In fact, only those in which HIV could be cultured, if only those in which HIV could be cultured were infected, he was putting forward an antibody test that would produce about 50% false positives. But in reality, HIV culturing was also not validated because pure HIV was not used in any of his experiments. So the rate of HIV-positive people could be from 0 to 100%. Gallo also claimed to have HIV antibodies for rabbit experiments, but there was no pure HIV available, and there still isn't, to expose the animals to. Thus, it could be that the rabbits were producing antibodies to non-HIV components of the impure materials, such as human blood serum, that was injected into them. A detailed critique of HIV testing was first put forward by the so-called Perth group, led by Eleni Papadopoulos-Eliopoulos. Their many challenges have never been answered, just ignored. Legally, this should mean that we cannot declare anyone to be definitely HIV infected, and therefore it should be impossible to convict anybody as positive by any type of HIV test. Next point is the assumption that HIV is sexually transmitted. The most comprehensive study of sexual transmission of HIV in a Western country was a paper published by Paddy in 1997. Quote, "We followed 175 HIV discordant couples over time. That means one is HIV positive, one's negative. For a total of approximately 282 couple years of follow-up. We observed no seroconversions after entry into the study." So in the best study of sexual transmission of HIV amongst couples, they found no couples in which transmission occurred. Another paper from 2005, which is a really good survey of young people in South Africa, found that 23.3% of young black women were HIV positive, but only 6.4% of young black men. 3.8% of female virgins were positive and 2.5% of male virgins. The study authors just assumed these people were lying. But what about the high rate, 23.3% among young black women versus 6.4% in men? What about the indicators of promiscuity? Well, not surprisingly, they were higher in men. There's no explanation for this. And this type of anomaly amongst the ratio of men to women in Africa is very common. A group led by David Giselquist has studied this for many years. Legally, lack of proof of sexual transmission of HIV should make it impossible to convict anybody. HIV causes immune deficiency, another assumption. This is generally measured by CD4 T-cell counts, even though it's been known for decades that low CD4 counts are sometimes found in healthy people. In fact, sometimes zero CD4 counts are found in healthy people. And many other things than HIV are known to change CD4 counts. Cigarette smoking, for example, is known to make them go up, and strenuous exercise makes them go down. Since low CD4 counts are considered to be bad, then cigarette smoking must be good for you, and exercise must be bad for you. Further, there's no mechanism accepted for how HIV kills CD4 cells. For example, there's very little correlation between viral load, which is supposedly the amount of the virus, and the quantity of CD4 cells, which supposedly tells you how badly bruised your immune system is. If we don't know how HIV kills CD4 cells, we don't know that it does. The lack of a causal connection between HIV and immune deficiency should make it impossible to convict anyone of endangering the life of someone by setting in motion a chain of events that's not been proven to cause immune deficiency. The assumption that HIV infection leads to AIDS in about 10 years and then death. Establishment scientists have created two terms, long-term non-progressor, abbreviated LTNP, and elite controller. Both categories include people who are HIV positive, have never taken AIDS drugs, and have remained healthy for many years with good numbers, i.e. high CD4 cell counts and an undetectable viral load. In some cases, healthy HIV positive, pharmaceutical-free people do not have high CD4 counts and low viral load and thus are not counted in these categories. If you included them, there'd be a lot more of these, but nobody knows how many of these people there are. Doctors never say, you know, there's a possibility that if you don't take drugs, you'll stay perfectly healthy. They still try to push everybody onto drugs, even though it's known that some people will be apparently unaffected by HIV in their body. The lack of certainty that an HIV-positive diagnosis will lead to AIDS should make it impossible to convict anyone of endangering the life of someone who becomes HIV-positive after having sex with them. Finally, let's go back to the beginning and address the assumption that HIV is a virus. This has been the most widely accepted part of the theory, but it was challenged by a few scientists since shortly after Gallo's 1984 announcement that he'd found the probable cause of AIDS. I believe it was first questioned by the so-called Perth group that started out trying to analyze the HIV tests. They pointed out that HIV has never been purified, and therefore not even the first link in the chain of logic called Koch's postulates have been successfully established. Robert Koch was a famous bacteriologist who discovered tuberculosis in the 1800s. He said that in order to prove that a pathogen causes a disease, you first need to purify it. You then need to inject it into a susceptible animal, and then you need to produce the same symptoms of disease, and then you need to purify it again. If you do that, you've proven that the pathogen is the probable cause of the disease. There was, for a long time, a material called purified HIV. They would grow, they would take materials from somebody believed to be HIV infected, such as blood serum, put them in a cell culture. They would culture for some time, several weeks or months. Then they would take what's known as the supernatant of this culture, the liquid over top of the cells that are in the culture. They would then centrifuge, spin at high speed, and take a particular density and say, this is pure HIV. So they did eventually put this material under an electron microscope, but although the HIV era started in 1984, it was not until March 1997 that papers analyzing this material were published, both in the same issue of the journal Virology. Both documented that the centrifuged pellets from HIV culturing were in fact over 90% impurities. Without pure materials, it's obviously impossible to obtain reference reagents such as antigens, antibodies, DNA, and RNA. All that really happened after this stunning result is they stopped talking about purified HIV and they started to talk about concentrated HIV. But the estimate that over 90% were impurities leaves open the possibility that 0% was actually HIV. It leaves open the possibility that there was no HIV in these samples at all. It's not the job of critics of the HIV-AIDS dogma to prove that HIV does not exist. That is as impossible as proving that Russell's teapot is not orbiting the sun. Russell was a philosopher, science philosopher, who, to illustrate the absurdity of the position that critics have to prove of something, said that he believed that there was a teapot orbiting the sun, and he challenged people to prove that it wasn't. His point was that if he hypothesizes this teapot, it's his job to provide some evidence before anybody should take it seriously. It's the job of HIV-AIDS proponents, including prosecutors in criminal cases, to prove that HIV does exist before bringing charges predicated on its existence. And it's the job of arbitrators to insist on this proof, i.e. judges. something they've really done, because the defense in legal cases have really rarely had the knowledge to know that this is a real issue, or the courage to put such an argument forth. Legally, if HIV has not been proven to exist, or at least not in biologically active quantities, it should be impossible to convict anyone of endangering the life of another person based on their HIV antibody status. So, in conclusion, Canadian legal decisions based on precedents rather than any HIV-specific law, because there isn't any, result in lengthy jail sentences for HIV-positive people by converting consensual sex into aggravated sexual assault simply by the undisclosed presence of HIV antibodies in one person. If the sexual partner becomes HIV-positive and later dies from a symptom of AIDS, even if that symptom is also a side effect of AIDS drugs, or even if the symptom apparently is a side effect of AIDS drug and is not a symptom of AIDS, they can be convicted of first-degree murder. Even without murder charges, sentences may well be over a decade. I've estimated that for each sexual partner for which there's not disclosure, the sentence is 2 to 3 years. Justices have, like most of the rest of society, simply accepted the dogma that HIV is sexually transmitted, causes AIDS, and then death, and that so-called HIV tests can accurately detect HIV infection. These assumptions are easier to sustain because of the moral judgments placed on the various risk groups. Gay men, IV drug users, black-skinned people, and the heterosexual partners of IV drug users who are often drug users themselves, although not IV drug users necessarily. The vast majority of HIV-positive people are believed to have acquired the virus either through sex, mostly gay male sex, or through drug use. This contrasts with many other viruses believed to be transmitted by circumstances that don't carry a severe moral burden, such as being bitten by a mosquito or through someone sneezing. There is increasing concern about the harsh sentences being given to HIV-positive people, but critics normally keep their arguments safe within the bounds of the HIV dogma. But that only makes the case against these sentences much harder to argue. If HIV truly is a deadly sexually transmitted virus, it would seem that having sex with someone without disclosing that you carry the virus is indeed endangering their life and should be punished. However, when the dogma is carefully examined, as has been done by a number of scientists and other researchers over many years, every part of the dogma is questionable. HIV tests clearly do not detect infection, they detect antibodies. There is little evidence of sexual transmission. And even mainstream HIV/AIDS scientists acknowledge that many people who test positive on HIV tests remain healthy for many years without AIDS drugs. There is no evidence that HIV actually does kill the CD4 cells that form part of the immune system. There's lots of evidence that other things change the level of CD4 cells in the body. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, there's no evidence that HIV has ever been purified, and therefore no evidence that HIV even exists. Thank you for listening to episode 150 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.